Welcome to the JP Morgan Weekender. I'm Bruce Kasman. With me this week from the other side of the world is Joe Lupton. Hey, Joe, how you doing?
I'm in the right side of the world, although we just had an earthquake. So maybe I shouldn't speak too soon. Actually, you should be the one having the earthquake sitting there in Tokyo, right?
I'm sitting here in Tokyo, you know, having landed this morning and probably, you know, not very conscious in terms of how tired I am. So apologies if I kind of lose the plot here.
Cherry blossoms.
That's tomorrow. Let's start with, I think the simple point here is, you know, our calls for resilience and growth and high for long on rates seems to be playing out pretty well here in a week in which we got another really strong employment report, but let's not lose sight of the PMIs as well. You know, one of our favorite obsessions. In terms of both signaling growth is going to be strong here. And I think we kind of, you know, one theme I keep wanting to hit on is the idea that even as we get more confident in the high for long theme, we're probably getting less confident in what does it mean in terms of this broader contours of the outlook. We came into the year thinking high for long would start to build vulnerabilities and begin to boil the frog, and you know, it just doesn't feel like that's happening. But there are some issues around what happens now, because the central banks have been guiding towards a lot of easing. If they start to take that back, what does that mean? But before we do that, you know, we can get into that, and we will. Why don't you just give me your, you know, three or four bullet points off the data this week, and then I'll do the same, and then we can kind of bang things about after that.
Yeah, well, look, I think we've been seeing all of these, the data has been, I guess, supporting the resilient growth and, you know, from, you know, broad-based income generation that started with a sense of robust labor markets, strong wage growth, kind of headline inflation rates coming down, purchasing power staying strong, all of that being strong income generation for the household sector. That got an added kick, I guess it was a couple weeks ago, in terms of what we got on U.S. profits, but the broad profit picture for businesses around the world, which we updated in a research note recently, showing that even that side of the equation is also seeing broad income generation. So that, I think, really sets the stage and got you and me excited about extending the life of the expansion even further, the same way it did, you know, when we were getting these data for the third quarter. And I think really, and I'm going to get off track a little bit from the data, but I just want to say, when you say we're questioning our framework a little bit and what it means, I would say what this means is it just pushes out the framework a little bit. It's the same kind of framework. It's just that we don't think that a recession dynamic is going to be taking place later this year, like a boil the frog scenario could have, or early next year, that this broad income generation is something that is going to give you legs to this expansion. So it's not changing things much. But let me, I'm sure we're going to go back into that. I just want to.
Oh, we're going to go back into that because I have a few things I want to say. But
yeah,
keep going. Finish your.
In terms of the data flow, you've got that. And of course, the US jobs report, you know, underscores all of that. But then you mentioned the PMIs this week, which were quite strong in every which way. And we saw hints of this in last month's report. And this was a furthering of that, in the sense that the overall index moved up yet again. It's now consistent with 2.9% annualized GDP growth, which you might say is consistent with our first quarter forecast.
Which, by the way, that's more than 0.5% above potential globally. So let's just kind of get that.
And not only that, I thought you were going to say it's also an upward revision from where we were at the start of the year, right? So we keep revising up the first quarter. But the point I want to stress is this is a March print, and we are currently have written down 2.3% global GDP growth for the second quarter. But of course, this momentum heading into the second quarter, you know, probably adds some upside risks to that as well, which is just a sign that what we've been doing really almost every quarter of this expansion is just starting the quarter with more downside and then having to catch up to the strength that we're seeing in the expansion. So the PMI show that. Adding, last thing I'll say to this, is not only broad-based income generation, is breadth across sectors, which is something we struggled with last year, where most of the growth, or all of the growth really, quite literally all the growth, was services, and manufacturing was pretty much stalled last year as a whole. We're starting to see broad-based increase in manufacturing and services. And that breadth is something combined with the breadth of income generation that I think makes you feel like there's a lot of fuel left here to keep things going on the growth side of things.
Okay, so let me throw a few observations from my end. One, I just want to make the point, which I'm not going to try to push very hard, but it is still a little frustrating when we see the PMI data. And as you say, hey, we're kind of seeing more breath with particular hopes that Europe is picking up. But then we look at the hard activity data coming in. It's not delivering it quite yet. That's a bit frustrating, but I'm with you in the sense that I'll take the signal from the survey data at this point as a better guide to what's ultimately going to happen, particularly since the European data is so slow and crappy in terms of its quality. I mean, this we bring ourselves in line with Greg Fuzesi, our Euro area economist, who constantly tells us wait for the revisions 3 years later.
That's not a comment to Eurostat, is it, Bruce?
take note. I guess the second point here is, I think, you know, along the lines of what you were describing about growth, we should also point the finger at the consensus in the U.S., the consensus forecast in the U.S. in a world in which people have been talking about supply side. They've been raising their estimates of what payroll growth can be sustained, but they have not carried that over to their GDP forecast. The consensus as of the March blue chip is still 1.5% for the four quarter change for this year. I think that's just too low, and that's something which we're almost certainly going to start to see people move on. But it has been, I think, taking too long for that process to happen. And then I think the final thing, and this is, you know, one of the issues you're kind of raising. You think you mentioned that you think what's happening here is we're just pushing it out in terms of the high for long, creating the pressures and the vulnerabilities. Well, ultimately, that's the case, because I think, you know, there's about 100% probability we'll have a recession at some point in the future. But I think if we talk about it over a relevant horizon, which is just, let's say, the 1 to 3 year horizon, let's just sort of think about that. One of the things that I'm questioning, you know, is whether or not we actually can live with a 4.5, you know, Fed funds rate, 4, 3.5 euro ECB policy rate, and still actually sustain these expansions. So I'm kind of, you know, wondering whether or not we really have the possibility here of just being far enough off on underlying conditions here that, you know, and then there's obviously the issue of whether central banks can get the inflation outcomes that they would need to be comfortable and not have to come back and think about tightening. But generally speaking, I think there's another branch of this probability tree, which we really weren't putting very much weight on 6 months ago, which is just you could be at high for long for a long time and continue to sustain expansions. But let me
basically the soft landing Goldilocks scenario,
which was the only soft landing scenario
we had, was a world where rates come down
exactly
and perfect. But maybe there's a soft landing Goldilocks scenario where rates stay high for long. And I agree.
High for very long. Because when we
is semantics, because that's what I was saying. I think what we keep getting is a signal of more and more resilience. And frankly, I keep characterizing as you just have these mid-cycle fundamentals that haven't been stretched enough to really feel the damage of higher rates. And that can extend maybe another 6 months. I don't know about 18 or what you're saying, 3 year horizon. I think if we're sitting at 450 for 3 years, that's probably going to be enough to slow things down quite considerably.
Well, that's where I'm more open-minded about today. But let me kind of jump into another space, because I think we're talking now about some more medium-term outlook scenarios. But we've got on the plate here the issue of what happens as we move towards the June meetings, where we have easings from the Fed, the ECB. We also have Bank of Canada. We got a whole bunch of central banks that we have meeting. And there's questions here. You could say, I'm going to put this out as a smaller issue, but does the Bank of Canada get into the picture here with a weak labor market report today? But let's all just talk about the Fed. You know, I think in the details of the report today, I think you did have a firm wage number. You had wages at 0.35 on the month of March. You had a tick revision upward in February. You're now running 4.4 on the first quarter on average hourly earnings. I'm going to take a bet, or at least have a bias, that the next DCI number, which is out at the end of April, is going to firm materially off of the fourth quarter number of last year. And then we're forecasting now another 0.3 on core CPI. So, you know, is the Fed going to have enough comfort to ease in June, when Powell seems to be continuing to hold line here? He has shifted a little bit, I think, from the FOMC press conference, but not that much.
Yeah, I mean,
so what are you thinking? What are you thinking there?
And you know, I mean, you and I anybody. You and I are in the same boat on this. I think if you know, you'd have to think the Fed's going to be a bit more cautious here, and I think I said it at the time that Powell's going to feel foolish having faded those two inflation prints so unequivocally at the time. And now I think, I mean, we'll see. Maybe inflation news is going to come in much softer, but it doesn't look like that. And you're going to be sitting there saying, oh, maybe there was a bit more signal there. In which case, it raises the question, as you're saying, do they get, there's two options. One is you could start later and continue at the pace of kind of like once a 25 a meeting or whatever, or you could start in June if they're kind of hell-bent on starting in June, but maybe skip some meetings in between. I've always leaned toward the former. I think the argument against that was this kind of weird election thing. People think they can't start in September because the election. That's never bothered me, just one, because the Fed has started before around elections, and two, because Powell has like just adamantly said this won't be an issue. You might say that's party line, but still, I don't think that will be an issue. So yeah, I would favor starting later and just continuing with 25. And I think everything we've seen and everything we've talked about suggests that the June start is underwater at this point.
I think just to kind of reiterate the point, it's definitely a underwater in a world in which we've got a 0.3. Something close to a clean 0.3 on core CPI next month's read, in the next week's reading, excuse me. And I, if we get a high side ECI report, and if we're continuing to rise up growth for the year, those things kind of seem to be all kind of going in that direction.
I've always said 3% was kind of the hurdle for them, or the sufficiency condition for them not to move, right? 2.5 run rate was sufficient for them to cut. 3 was sufficient for them not to cut. We're talking about numbers that would be well above 3.
The CPI is going to be blowing above 3. The question is whether PC on a year ago basis could be still at 2.5 around the time
But what would the, say, quarter on quarter be?
Right now we're tracking 4.41 or 4.2 on CPI core for Q1 and something like 3.4 on PC. And then the second quarter, you know, we'll be tracking hopefully lower on both fronts. But probably not enough to push either one of those two on a first half basis below 3. And then, you know, the issue is that the PC will be running a probably about 3 on the first half and about 2.5 on the OYA when the Fed sits down to meet in June.
Check your view on this, because I hear people that I listen to and respect, they're more kind of the market participant side of it, saying like, look, 2 to 3, who cares? You're kind of in the range. Like 3% is not that big a deal. I push back and say the 3% is a big deal to the Fed. You agree with that? I mean, is that something, or do you think the Fed might say, look, we're in the ballpark, 2 to 3, who cares? We can start easing at this point.
So I think the higher you get to 3 in terms of where we're settling in the first half of the year, to get the Fed to ease off of that, you have to have other things that are kind of providing more confidence that you're going to move down from there pretty quickly. So the problem I think you have, if we're sort of talking about this in terms of the metrics for the June meeting, is that if I had sat here 3 months ago and you told me that the first half is going to average 3, but we would have payroll growth slowing to 150 and we'd have an unemployment rate at 4 and we'd have financial conditions tightening, I'd say, you know, the call. But now you have that inflation profile with the job numbers
still continued strong growth.
And then you see it's the interaction of those things, which I think make it harder. Because I think what matters in terms of how the Fed reads the current inflation readings is how confident are they that, you know, because we're in an elevated inflation world, whatever the readings are, they want it at some point to get down closer to 2. So they say, get that, and B, how much half is materially restrictive, which is the way they were describing it. And I think both of those things are coming under here.
Yeah.
Is this issue of how do markets deal with this? So let's just say we take a Fed out in June, let's just say for argument's sake, and we start to erode, as we have in the pricing of what was at the start of the year, 200 basis points of Fed easing over 2025. How much of the problem? One argument I can make is we have to be careful about thinking that what the news flow is telling us is that our star is really high, because the Fed has been enabling markets to price in substantial soft landing like easing from the central bank. And if you take that out, maybe our star isn't that high, but just the markets were just too exuberant was. So like how much of a threat is it to the market if we start to say, okay, the Fed may do a couple of easings this year, but it's only maybe going to do 100 basis points cumulatively over 24, 25, which I think absent a recession is to me a reasonable baseline to be working with.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, as you said, it comes down to how much of this is just a story of strong growth and continued resilience, and therefore you kind of need higher rates to keep your foot somewhat on the brake, but allow the expansion to continue. And how much of it is just, you know, the strength in the economy coming from these very easy conditions that are going to reverse quickly if we take out those rate cuts. I mean, I was kind of asking Jay, our rate strategist, about this on the call yesterday. And, you know, if we kind of pushed things out to, you know, took out the 75 basis points of cuts this year and pushed it into next year, I don't know. It didn't seem like it was going to be too alarming on what he would do to his 10-year forecast. I mean, I think his beta is roughly about 0.3 or 0.3, 0.4. I don't think that would be enough to slow things down. The bigger question, of course, would be, does the equity markets really kind of puke on this? And you're talking about 20, 25%.
So you got a bunch of things. Correction. You got the equity markets. You've got the degree to which the pressure, possibly partly coming from the dollar, could take out central bank easing elsewhere. You got a bunch of things here, and I think this trade-off between a repricing towards a less dovish or less easing by the Fed that comes because the world is better and you don't need it is a lot different than a repricing because the Fed has to put its foot on the brake and has to commit to weak growth ahead. And those two things.
I just want to say something on the dollar point, because this came up in our conversations with the team earlier this week. And I think you can't separate the dollar point as some independent thing from this growth point, right? I mean, because I was pushing back because they were saying, oh, this strong dollar is hurting the EM economies. I was like, well, hold on a second. The dollar is kind of strong if it's because of strong U.S. growth. And I'm telling you, U.S. is going to be, you know, running kind of 3% again this year, and imports are going to be up. Boy, you should feel really good about that. And by the way, the weaker currency against the U.S. dollar is just going to amplify the growth impulse, right? I mean, this idea of channeling to the capital flow story is I don't want to ignore it.
There's trade-offs there, too, to the extent that it's U.S. exceptionalism. You get higher a dollar and possibly less flexibility on your central banks, offsetting stronger U.S. demand. There's both of those impulses in the
Say feel like people kind of forget about the stronger U.S. demand point. And if it's a stable global expansion, boy, I would feel pretty good about the macro side of the EM in that world, particularly if after a year and a half of kind of a stall in manufacturing and manufacturing starting to come back to life here. That would just make me even more kind of excited about the EM story.
Well, one of the interesting points here, which I think I want to get more validation on, is if you take a look at the PMI surveys and you take a look at the commodity market space as a whole, it does suggest something cyclically is happening, which is broader than just a U.S. story.
Yeah.
You know, again, we don't have the data in Europe or Japan kicking in yet. So we want to see, and I think Western Europe is a key part of this story, but the surveys are starting to move. Commodity markets have moved. There's definitely, I think, indications here, which suggests we should be thinking about not just a U.S. story of outperformance here, but something that's broader. You know, yeah. Somebody singing happy birthday in the background. I don't know if you picked that up, but
no, I didn't. But
but it's so no, I don't think it's either your or my birthday, but somebody's birthday somewhere. God. So happy birthday. But before we leave, we mentioned Canada. Give us a quick read there.
Well, I mean, I think as you said, first of all, let me say, like, I despite the upside surprises on inflation in a lot of parts of the world, Canada's inflation seems to have been coming down at a decent pace. And a lot of the pressure.
And they're softer. They don't have the same growth resilience the U.S. is having, right?
Well, I was going to get to that. You're kind of seeing that as well. And that coupled with the labor market report this morning, that was pretty darn weak. The call was that they cut alongside the Fed and ECB in June, but they have a meeting coming up here next week for the April meeting. That's always been kind of an outside bet that some people have been taking. Today's labor report probably adds a little bit of increased odds to that. We're not changing our call there. But nonetheless, okay. I think that's a part of the story. We also have the ECB next week, where, you know, we are expecting, obviously not to do anything, but there we're a little puzzled by the kind of strong calendar guidance for June, but then data dependence beyond June. It's like they want to have their cake and eat it too. We'll probably try to see a kind of a reinforcement of that message next week.
Okay. We'll finish up here. Talk to you again next week on the weekender.